Welcome back. By the way, if you're new here, my name's Joel. I'm one of the leaders in the church. And if you're joining us at Shoreham or the Racecourse or at the Villas in Hove through the video, welcome. It's really good to be talking with you today. As a church, we are going through some teaching from the book of Samuel in the Bible. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 5 today. And it's really a helpful way of learning about how to know God and how to serve God in the difficulties of real life. And it's the story of a king, David, a man who grew up as a shepherd boy, chosen to be king at a young age, went through all kinds of suffering before he became finally the king of Israel and actually became one of the great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers, one of the ancestors of Jesus Christ. And there's loads we can learn about God, about ourselves, about life through his story. So we're in 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 to 12. I'll read that bit of the story to you today. It says this: "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, 'Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, "You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel." So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off," thinking, "David cannot come in here." Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. David said on that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul. Therefore it is said, 'The blind and the lame shall not come into the house.'" And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built the city all around from the Millo inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons, who built David a house. And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. Okay, so we have this story of this leader who's come into a position of authority which is completely new for him. It's a massive promotion. He's been a shepherd boy, he's been a fugitive, he's been public enemy number one for much of his life, and everything has turned around now. The circle has closed and he is in power. It's quite a remarkable thing for someone to be brought into this level of authority. I remember watching an interview with Tony Blair a few years ago where he talked about his first day at number 10. This would be back in 97. And the words of the, I guess, whichever staff official it was in Downing Street who greeted him as he came through the door, and sort of everything was kind of ready and the euphoria had died down, and the person looked him in the eye and said, "Well, Prime Minister, what is it that you would like to do first?" And that's a very meaningful question for someone who's just been handed over the keys of government for a whole nation. What is it you would like to do first, Prime Minister? People often talk in the States about the first 100 days. Every president has their first 100 days, first 3 months. What can they get done? The first 100 days tend to count quite a lot. And here we're seeing David's attitude to power. There was a book I read a few years ago called, I think it was called The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership by a man called Stephen Sample. And he had a chapter in it called Being President versus Doing President. He makes the point that for many people, the acquisition of power and status and position becomes such an end in itself that by the time they actually reach power, by the time they get into office, they have nothing left in the tank. They've run out of ideas and inspiration. They don't really know what to do. Their goal was to get power. The goal was not to do anything with it. And it's one thing to be president. It's one thing to be king. It's another thing to do king, because you know you were put in a place for a reason. There's something to be delivered. There's some ideas that need planning and execution. There's a responsibility. There's a burden, a task to be done. Whatever it is, whether it's glamorous or whether it's painful and agonizing, there's a task. And David knows that, because you can see straight away. What would you like to do, Mr. Prime Minister? He's going to take this city called Jerusalem. He's got reasons for that, which if we lived at the time, we'd understand better. But let me just kind of give you one or two key reasons for it. He's lived through a long season of civil war. He's down in the south in Judah, in Hebron, the city where he was based. And up in the north, there's all the other tribes of Israel. There's a lot of division. The place where he's going to base himself is therefore really important. It's a bit like in Australia when there was big rivalry between Sydney and Melbourne as to which was the key city. And so when they chose the capital, they actually made a new one. They chose a place called Canberra, a nowhere place. But basically, it was a way of defying the rivalry between the two. And David's copying that story. Oh, they're copying it from David, I should say. David's kind of thinking, okay, I'm going to find a neutral place that is a healthy setup, good fortress, good strong place for location, and it's going to become my city, my base from this time onwards. Which, when you think about it, shows a supreme amount of confidence. For a couple of reasons. One of them is that it's a pretty hard place to get. And secondly, it's because when he gets it, he calls it the city of David, as if to kind of make it very clear. Okay, I'm stepping up. I want you to understand, I intend to rule. I have a plan. I'm going to name this city after myself. I'm that confident. I'm that secure in my sense of responsibility. See that in verse 7, the way, you know, you've had this long fight, this long holding out of enemies against David. And then verse 7, nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. That is the city of David. He took it and he named it again. I think they call that chutzpah, or whatever the word is. I can't pronounce it properly, but it's kind of amazing confidence. Where did you get that from? What is that about? I wonder if it's worth just delving in a bit, because I think it's necessary to distinguish that kind of confidence with arrogance. Is David just proud? Is he an arrogant person? Well, no doubt he had to fight arrogance all his life, I'm sure. He had to deal with pride like we all do. But you wouldn't say, reading his story, that pride was the deep problem in David's life, that pride was the kind of constantly manifesting thing. In fact, in many ways, he's striking for his humility. He's not so full of himself as his predecessor, Saul, was. Saul was definitely proud and suffered and ultimately perished because of it. It was his pride that landed him in his destruction. David was not like that. David's a humble man. So what is it? What is this incredible confidence he's got? I'm going to take the place. I'm going to name it after myself. It's easy to mistake arrogance with calling. David is fully aware of his sense of calling. His sense of destiny, his sense of purpose has gripped him. He's jealous about it. He's red hot with passion to achieve the things that God chose and called him distinctly to do. He knows that there's something on God's mind. There was something on God's mind when God leaned over heaven and put his finger on a shepherd boy in Bethlehem and said, I'm going to raise you up. David understood from that point on, God has called me for a reason. There's a purpose, there's a plan. This isn't an accident. I'm not on the throne to sit here. He wants something done. It is an incredible privilege. It's at the core of my identity now. I'm called by God, called with destiny. People who act out of a sense of calling can come across in the wrong way. They can be perceived as arrogant. Perhaps because they're decisive, they're clear, they're focused. They won't compromise, they won't negotiate. They know what they're called to do and they pursue it wholeheartedly. And that can make people uncomfortable, it can make us feel awkward, it can make us think, well, surely you're just full of yourself. It's not necessarily the case. It can be possible to be thoroughly convicted about truth and sense of calling and yet genuinely a humble person. Surely Jesus is the great model of that. And actually, conversely, you can get people who come across as humble and they score all the humble points and they tick all the humble boxes, but in reality, God's assessment of them is that they're arrogant. God sees them the opposite. God knows their heart from afar. There's people in this book that God has trouble with, not because they're too ambitious, because they have too high a sense of calling. It's because they don't. There's people in this book that God has to rebuke because they basically say, yeah, I know that you've called me to do something great for you, but I don't believe you. I choose instead to believe my doubts, my sense of failure, my sense of weakness, my sense of disappointment, the tapes I will play in my head, the ongoing dialogue I'll have with myself will be about how it's never going to happen. I'm never going to change. I am basically going to fail. And I hear all the things that you say, God. I hear the promises that you make. I hear the fact that I've been called, but really that doesn't ring true anymore. It just seems like vain optimism. And I'm tired of it. I'm just weary of it. And so I quit. And that's the story of many in this book. And when God speaks to them, you can be surprised at the tone. So a whole load of people in the book of Numbers were told, go in and take some territory that I have promised to you. It had been promised to them for hundreds of years, and they were the privileged generation that had been called to go in and get it. And they held back. They said, no, it's too difficult. The cities are too big. The people are too intimidating. It cannot be done. Effectively saying to God, you cannot be trusted. You say big, ambitious things, but we don't believe you. God's response is, well, you can see it in Numbers chapter 14, the way he speaks to them, verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, how long will this people despise me? And how long will they not believe me in spite of the signs that I have done among them? It's possible to cause God that grief, that response, not by our overwhelming ambition, friends, but by our sheer lack of it, our sheer lack of desire to achieve anything for him, our sheer lack of conviction about the calling he's given us, the things he's told us and promised us. And leaders, in whichever context, whether it's pastors of a church like me or leaders in all kinds of settings, whether it's your business, your workplace, you will feel often the tussle between what am I called to do in this situation and what's the other route that I could take that would perhaps come across a little bit better. And you say, well, I'm not a leader. I tell you, every one of you in your walk of life, there are in each of our lives a measure of calling. There is a way in which God has looked at you, formed you, designed you, custom designed you, hardwired you, planned your life. The Bible puts it like this in Ephesians chapter 2, works foreordained that we should walk in them. He's committed them to you, and he's saying, I have a calling and a plan. And yet it is possible for us to shrink back because we're way more aware of the intimidating circumstances or, and this is maybe the bigger pressure for some others of us, we're way more aware of our own failure, our poor track record, our sense of weakness. And that's impressive to us more than what God has said to us. David somehow overcame that. David was persuaded. David was serious. He took this concept of calling very seriously. And in that sense, he's no different than any other child of God. If you're someone who knows Jesus Christ, someone here who follows Jesus Christ, it's true of you. You've been called. You didn't fall into church by accident. You didn't drift into a relationship with God. It wasn't even ultimately your choice. Jesus said it to his disciples, "You didn't choose me, I chose you. I appointed you." Paul puts it really strongly in Ephesians in the New Testament, chapter 4, verse 1. He's speaking to this mighty church. "I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord," listen, this is a big thing, "a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called." He's not saying that to the leaders. He's not saying that to the entrepreneurs, to the outstanding Christians. He's saying it to the church en masse, the Christians, the gathered community of people who, some of them have been Christians for a moment, perhaps, just a few days. Some of them, maybe a shorter future, they're in their later years, but they're in Christ's hands. And Paul says, live in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called. He's gripped by it. If you know God, it's because he called you. He planned it with intention, with purpose, with fire in his eyes, as the book of Revelation says. He's excited about it even if you're not. Maybe you're not a Christian yet. You think, if I become a Christian, what will that mean for my life? Well, I tell you, it would be better for your life than anything you could imagine. Because what could be better than being called by God? Called to know him, to relate to him, to serve him, to do his work, not just any work, but God's work. And there's nothing that really satisfies the human soul better anyway. Many of us have tried many things. Come back to this one who calls us. You need to be gripped by it, friends. You need to understand the significance of it and step up to it. Sometimes it means shedding things from the past. It's necessary in David's life. He realizes, I'm called to be king. I'm not a shepherd boy anymore. I'm just not what I was. I'm not going to get airs and graces. I'm not going to be arrogant. But I'm going to step up to the authority, the mantle, the responsibility. It's going to be difficult. It's going to create challenges, but he's called me to be king. And so he presses into his new life. He takes it as a challenge, and he says goodbye to the past. It's fitting. It's some of the translations of that verse in Ephesians 1, a life that is fitting to the calling. You know what that word conjures up. It conjures up for me. You know, what is that? Is that way you're acting or behaving, or even that way you're dressing, fitting to who you are? You know, when you see someone in their 70s, well, you probably don't, but some, you know, you can imagine someone in their 70s and 80s dressing as an 11-year-old. And it's just weird. It's not fitting. It's it's not you. It's not who you are. And sometimes guys will do a subtler version of that. You know, we dress as kids right up into our middle years. We can't really shake it off. We can't shake off the PlayStation. We can't shake off the kind of the fascinations and the passions that really, you know, you ought to be able to say goodbye to at some stage. And if you want to play with a PlayStation in your 30s and 40s, then let it be with in a way that helps you to bond with losers who play PlayStations. Okay, that's allowed, all right? That's fine. You're allowed to do that. Don't be the loser. Just bond with the loser, all right? That's fine. Do it for their sake, not for your sake. Because it's time to say goodbye. It's time to say, I want to live in a way that's true and fitting to the calling. I've been called. I'm not just fallen into church. I've not just been forgiven for my sin. How wonderful it is to be forgiven for our sin. But more than that is spoken over you. You've been called by the king, summoned to a task, and to step up to it is so appropriate. Sometimes in my kind of Englishness, my kind of, I don't know what to call it, maybe it is Englishness, maybe it's just timidity, I can lapse into a self-deprecating tone. And it's partly kind of, maybe it's just there's a tiny trace of humility in it. Maybe it's just wanting to endear myself to other English people who like to hear people self-deprecate. That's all right, fair enough. But I know that there's other times when what I'm doing is simply not believing God. Remember once when I was leading a prayer meeting and I'd been written to by some kind of gathering in the city. It was to do with it was an official thing. I was invited, along with a few other senior figures in the city, to a special dinner where there was going to be a presentation and some kind of discussion about the future of such and such. And it was being held in a kind of important civic place. And I was written to it, and I thought, oh, okay, wow, that's interesting. Okay, I'll probably go to that. And I said to the prem, you guys gathered in this room, I said, oh, we've got this thing coming up. I'm going to be at it. Good to pray. Perhaps you could pray for me that God helps me to be faithful and serve him well when I'm there. And I said something like, goodness knows why I got invited. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. That was just something like, you know, things that British people say. And I just, you know, let that carry on and just didn't think anything more about it. After praying, my dad comes over to me, grabs me by the elbow, which is usually it means something. I've learned that that's code for something. And I'm thinking, okay, we're going to have a conflict here. He's going to tell me off. What's it going to be about? And I thought, what have I done? Have I sworn? Have I blasphemed? Said something bad? He said, I'm not sure. I quite like the way you said that. Oh, gosh, what was it? He said, when you said that thing about why have I been invited to this? He said, have you been called by God to this city or not?
Yeah, I have.
He's right. He's right. David wouldn't do that. But if he caught himself thinking that, he would step up, wake up. No, I've been called by God. I'm a man of destiny. I've got a future in his plan, his purpose. I belong in places like that as much as anybody. God called me here. It goes against the grain a little. Doesn't mean we have to be obnoxious. Doesn't mean that self-deprecation is wrong. It's not bad to laugh at yourself. It's bad not to. Trust me, I'll carry on self-deprecating because it's funny. But I'm not going to yield to that strange spirit, false humility, that blocks off the things that God has said to us as a church. God has told me to do. God has told you to do. It's not the way people of God behave. Remember recently a friend of mine told me about a decision he was making about sacrifice for the sake of the church, stuff he was having to give up, stuff he was tussling over. Should I do this or should I not do this? He was asking me for advice. And it was a huge issue. It was to the sum of money, figures that I hadn't really come to terms with perhaps until then. He was saying to me, I'm just thinking through what I should do about this situation. And I was gripped, not just by the fact he was being humble enough to ask my opinion, but gripped by the fear of God. Because I felt like God was saying through this, it's no small work I've called you to. People are giving their lives to this. People are giving their wealth to this. Walk in a manner worthy of the calling. That's true of all of us, brothers and sisters. If you're in this church, you know what I mean. If you're visiting us, we love you. We're just glad you're here. We are so glad to get to know you, but we feel called by God to a task. We want to keep going with it, to see lives change, to see transformation all over the place. Let me just touch on three things as a way of applying this. I think if you know that you have a sense of calling from God, it will affect three things, obviously. It will affect your decisions. You will decide wisely. It will seem unwise sometimes. Those looking on will be surprised at your decisions, but you will make intentional decisions. You won't drift. You will decide. Why? Because God called. God spoke. It will affect your decisions with regard to relationships, obviously with regard to finance. You've heard a lot about that today. It will affect your decisions about location, about work, and anything that you give your heart to because you're gripped by a sense of calling. It will affect conflict in your life. You'll have to accept the fact that those who are called carry a responsibility of conflict. It doesn't mean that you're pitching for a fight. It doesn't mean you're obnoxious. But it means you're not surprised when conflict comes. You see the difference? You're not the one that longs for conflict. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. He also said, woe to you when all men speak well of you. Blessed are you when you are persecuted and reviled. He says, dance for joy. Rejoice, for great is your reward in heaven, because just in such a way they persecuted the prophets before you. Jesus is saying, don't be surprised by it. Don't be surprised if Following your calling, responding to your calling with confidence creates conflict occasionally, creates situations where you feel, gosh, this is a little uncomfortable. I wanted to keep everybody, I wanted to be the peacemaker. I wanted to make everybody happy. I wanted to keep everybody sweet. Trust me, you never will. You cannot do that. Choose to say goodbye to that weird idol, worshipping at the altar of making everybody like you. It's a false idol, and it will take you down. Say goodbye to it. It doesn't mean that we look to be obnoxious. There's other verses in the Bible as well, all right? But hear me on this. David understood, if I'm going to be king, if I'm going to rule on God's behalf, I'm going to have to fight for it. I'll have to be prepared for conflict, even against such a mighty people as the Jebusites. And this is the third thing, okay? So decisions, conflict, and then thirdly, dealing with the past. Dealing with your demons. Dealing with the past. See, Jerusalem was like this really ugly situation, and it had plagued the nation for years and years. The Jerusalem situation, how awful that for so long, this city that God promised. You go back to Genesis 15 and you get the very clear words that God spoke to their forefather, Abraham, when he says to them how he wants them to have the land, verses 18 and 19. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham saying, to your offspring, I give this land. From the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Cadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and last but not least, the Jebusites. They're in there too. This tribe that have taken this stronghold of Jerusalem, when they don't possess it, it's not theirs to have. And you know, a sinister tribe, not good people, not nice people. Horrible practices these Canaanite tribes got up to for generations, sacrificing children, all kinds of revolting things. This ugly tribe having this kind of effectively ugly citadel in the middle of the country, down in the south, I suppose, but pretty central. And no one's done anything about it. No one's got the courage. No one's got no one feels the conviction. We just put up with it. We just yield to it. We just allow it. We just, okay, we'll always have that limp. We'll always have that issue. And we just try not to talk about it. And we just kind of just pretend it's not really there until David comes along. Remember him years ago before? Just the same situation. This giant comes out to face the armies of God, Goliath, and no one wants to talk about it. Everyone's looking at their shoes. It's all a bit awkward. He says, who's going to fight me? No one wants to fight you. David says, who is this Philistine? Is he? Is he one of God's people? No. There you see that sense of calling all over again. Is he arrogant? No, he's not arrogant. He's just persuaded. He's convinced. Are you convinced? I need to be convinced. We always live in that place saying, God, help my unbelief. Keep me strong in faith. David comes to that city with the same attitude he came to Goliath. I'm going to take this place down. Nevertheless, David took that city. Let me apply this to your life. Those things in your life, those shadows, those strongholds of the mind, those things that you kind of tolerate, kind of say, well, I just don't think anything's going to ever change in that situation in my life. That area of weakness and failure, it's not that weakness is the problem, it's just that you've allowed a kind of a worship of another God to grip you. It's like another God. It's like a city that's given over to another God in your life. A destructive God. I don't know what it would be, an addiction, an area that where you just feel crippled by the past, things that have happened to you, and they grip you to the point where you don't really feel free from them. You know what they are because even as I'm talking, your heart beats perhaps a little faster, feel a little bit awkward, don't really know what to do. When the Bible says, walk in a manner worthy of the calling you have, it's talking about those kinds of things, friends. You've been called. God doesn't put up with you. He doesn't tolerate you. He doesn't say, I'll let you in. He says, I choose you. I, I, I've planned so much for you. I've planned to make you holy and blameless before me. His purposes in your life are inevitable. If he's called you, he will prepare you for eternity. So we need to look at those demons, if you like, those strongholds, those things in our past, those Jebusite tribes that control. We need to look at them according to that. We look at through the lens of calling. Are you called by God? If you know that, it will grip you more and more. And more than the gripping of the past. I think this is relevant on a big scale as well, not just on a personal scale. See, you know, I'm a pastor of a church in the most secular city in the UK. Christianity's had its go in Europe, they say. It's gone, really. It's gone now. It's had its chance. It had, you know, pretty much 1600 years of success. That's a pretty good show. And now, you know, we've moved on. Here we are in Brighton, very good example of the secular urban context. I think, how are we really going to help people to meet Jesus in this city? How are we going to show ordinary Brightonians that Jesus is alive, that he's real? He's really real. How are we going to do that? It can feel like such a Jerusalem, such a city of Jebusites, such a stronghold. How do we do this? And then I spend time in other cities. You know, it's like God says, here, I want you to reach Brighton. And when that's done, I want you to reach Amsterdam and Berlin, like two of the most secular cities in the world. So I went with Matt and Joe Simmons yesterday and the day before in Amsterdam. Had a brilliant time with them. They're doing incredibly well. You'll be so proud of them if you know them. Should be proud of them anyway. The kids in school, Matt told me heartbreaking stories, getting his poor little girls into a school, Dutch school, where they didn't feel at home, didn't understand the language. And just all the changes, all the difficulties, pushing through the first few months of pain, gathering a little community, about a dozen people, just reaching out to them. Reaching out to the city in a tiny little way, and you think, what are we doing here? I get off planes and sometimes I walk into cities and think, what am I doing here? And we call this message House of Cards, because that's really what Jerusalem was. It looked so imposing and impregnable, but it's a house of cards. Why? How do I know that? Because actually God rules history. God's in control of times and seasons and cities and nations and trends. Nothing's outside of his perfect control. He can turn things around in an instant. He can do that. He can do that. David is told, you will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame will see you off. David says, I'm taking it. Because he knows too much. He knows it's a house of cards. Without God building the house, it will fall. It will fall. God's control, God's involvement is the only thing that gives us confidence in situations where we need to build, where we need to trust, where we need to take those kinds of decisions. And so I'm walking through Holland thinking, what's someone like me doing here? And I'm praying about this subject, House of Cards, thinking about it. You know what I saw as soon as I came out of the train station? You just show this picture. You know, this is right in front of the red light district. About 1,000 prostitutes working a night in Amsterdam. City that is in terrible need, although it likes to cover it up and show that it's a glamorous, glossy place where you'll always feel fulfilled. Lives betrayed, daughters kidnapped. It's a house of cards. It takes some kind of confidence to believe it, but that's what you and me are heirs to, that confidence that David had, that the son of David has and gives to us. It happens again and again through history. You get to things like 1989 where the Berlin Wall came down. No one would have thought that was going to happen. No one would have known that God would just wipe the power, the stronghold of Soviet-controlled Eastern Europe off the map of history. It looks like, wow, it's just, wow, no one saw that coming. And then people start saying, well, now, because of this, we predict the rest. start saying, oh, now let's start writing books. Fukuyama wrote his book, The End of History. You know, we're now marching into a period of peace and prosperity and capitalism across the nations. It's all going to be fine. And then you get the Gulf Wars, you get 9/11, you get Iraq, you get Afghanistan. It's like, not so soon. You can't predict the seasons, the times. You don't know what God will do. We don't know what God will do in this nation. We just know that God's plan and purpose is revealed in Scripture more than once, where he says, the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's his promise. That's his intention. That's his plan. And when God makes plans, he's not making them up. He calls, and he's not a liar. If he's called you to a destiny, if he's called this church to a destiny, we can take it very seriously. We've got permission to dream. We've got permission to plant churches. We've got permission to start services. We've got permission to reach your neighbors, to do Christmas services, to invite our friends, to think of how can we live in such a way that's worthy of the calling that we've been given. Because we know that history's a bit stuck, apparently, but it's never really stuck. God can turn things around suddenly. In China, they threw the missionaries out in the 50s. They said Chinese Christianity is over. Killed off loads of leading Chinese Christians, said it's done, it's finished, it's gone. Of course, now there are about 100 million Chinese Christians. God can't be thwarted. He can't be locked out. So let me just apply this to us in one other way, and that's just to draw attention to what makes David even more special. So you see David here as a as a pretty formidable military figure. In fact, to be really honest with you, he's a little bit embarrassing at one stage. You know, they say, the blind, the lame will keep you out, David and your friends. And then he says, very well, we'll take the city, and from now on, your name will be the blind and the lame. That's how he refers to the Jebusites. And he ends up with that slogan, the blind and the lame are not welcome in the house, shall not come into the house. That doesn't sound nice. That's not how to win friends and influence people. That's like a slogan. Imagine that written over the church door as people come in. No blind and lame people here, thank you very much. Sounds a bit 1970s to me. It's just like, it's not good. Here's the thing. Was that David just being... What is that? What's going on with David? Is that him just getting into a kind of slightly bloodlust kind of attitude? Possibly. Possibly. David wasn't beyond disgraceful behavior. Okay, I'm not painting a saint here. He's a bad man. You're going to find that out in the next few weeks, next week especially. So come back next week, all right? Trust me, you want to come back next week. It's very bad stuff. He's not perfect. I don't know. Some of the commentators say, well, it means this, it means that. We don't know. It could be that he's just being rude. So we think, is that what God wants us to be? Are we supposed to be? Is that his style? And if so, then I'm out. Not just because I'm offended, but because I'm blind and lame. I mean, I'm not tough. David's tough. He took a city with a few mates, went up a water shaft. Who knows what that means? Weird. Just did a Braveheart on this place. Just took it out. Amazing. I'm not one of them. If I'm in Braveheart, I'll be one of the guys in the castles, you know, checking out our clothes. That's why I'd be like, just, I'm not that guy. I'm not that tough. I'd like to be, but let's be real. I grew up in Ho, for goodness sake. Come on. So what chance have I to be David? No chance. I'm one of the blind and the lame. This is what I love. David turns up in Jerusalem. First thing he says, blind and the lame, no entry here. Do you know what happens in Matthew chapter 21? Verse 14. Jesus turns up in Jerusalem, son of David. Hundreds and hundreds of years later, the blind and the lame came to him in the temple and he healed them. Wow. Do you think he was trying to say something? Yeah, that's the same place where the children are all singing, Hosanna to the Son of David. The Son of David. He's come to the city. He's come to the city of David. He's come to kill the Romans. He's come to flash his sword. He's come to destroy anyone who's tough. Sign up with this guy now. What does Jesus do, first of all? Priority number one. What would you like to do, Mr. Prime Minister? Where are the blind and the lame? We want to throw them out? No, I want to heal them. Because they're going to be my champions. They're going to be my trophies. The future of the city of David, friends, the eternal Jerusalem, is that it's built on weak failures like you and me. And the way to be confident, whether it's facing the difficult decisions in your life, facing the most secular city in the United Kingdom, facing Amsterdam and the red light district, or Berlin and the secular atheism that seems to rule in such places, is not to chest up, remember a few memory verses and push through the wall. The way ultimately will be resting in His ability, trusting in His power, going back again and again, daily, weekly, monthly, annually, to the promises He's made to unworthy, undeserving failures like me. And I'm not just talking here. I know it. As a pastor, I'm just increasingly aware of my weaknesses, increasingly tired of myself, increasingly disappointed with myself. And I have a feeling that's going to carry on. Paul said, I'm the chief of sinners, in the last letter of his life. But I'm also increasingly persuaded that David's greater son is on the throne and he's with me. He's with me. I know he is. Shouldn't be by rights, but he really is. And he's with you if you know him. And he's for you. And his plans will not be thwarted in your life.